Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Hello, and welcome to the I'd Like to Add You to My Professional Network edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week, which this week means the news that Microsoft has decided to drop $26 billion on acquiring a social network, because who doesn't want a social network these days? There's a bunch of sort of non-Microsoft, non-social networky aspects to this deal, which is why we're devoting the whole episode to it. It's going to be fun. We are joined, as ever, by Cathy O'Neill, the blogger and data scientist at mathbabe.org.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Cathy. And we are joined by the Moneybox columnist at Slate, Jordan Weissman.
Hello, Felix.
But most importantly, and one of the main reasons, in fact, the main reason why this is the podcast that you need to listen to at least three or four times because it's that awesome, is that we are joined by the one and only Paul Ford. Hello, Paul.
Sorry, everybody.
Paul Ford is the Paul Ford is the most intelligent person in the world. He has an agency which does something so complicated that I can't even begin to describe it, called Postlight.
It's a product studio in New York City. We build big, beautiful digital things.
So yeah, this is like my knowledge of digital
apps.
is basically it. I start losing comprehension the minute that somebody starts using the word product.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it? It's a horrible word.
But it's a horrible word.
It has, unfortunately, it carries certain signifiers in the industry. We can't be without.
You can't, like, X-nay that word.
Well, because I want to do is just be like, I make things for you on computer. Like, that's what I want to say. But that doesn't actually, you don't give a guy a lot of money to do that.
Is it software or is it also hardware?
No, we don't do hardware yet. It's named Postlight just in case screens go away and it needs to be Postlight. But for right now, most of the things we do, I like to future-proof a little bit. Most of the things we do, we'll build. You come to us and you say, I need this really like complex, weird app. I have this ugly web problem from 10 years ago and there's 50 people working on it. And oh my God, what do I do? We're those guys.
So it's kind of like therapy too.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I mean,
So there are two main reasons.
Is my ad over? Can't keep going.
No, I'm staying on subject here. There are two main reasons I wanted Paul to join. The first main reason I wanted Paul to join us this week was because he wrote an absolutely wonderful Medium post about all of the sort of dystopian future that this deal portends. But the second reason is that in a previous existence, he actually used to be a management consultant. So he can
Back to it.
He can help to translate some of the weird words like products and enterprise, which we don't really know what they mean, into English for us. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about capital stacks and capital structures. We're going to talk about insider trading. You have no idea. We have all manner of stuff. But Paul, first, I suppose you really ought to tell us what we're talking about here.
So when was it? Was it Monday? Monday morning, we all woke up to the news, the very surprising news that Microsoft, which is a little company people might have heard of that makes things like Microsoft Office, went ahead and bought LinkedIn, the large professional social network that globally connects people into one giant professional hairball and lets them sort of recruit each other.
So my first reaction to this was like to like delete my LinkedIn account, but then I realized I'd already deleted my LinkedIn account.
See that? I can't even protest.
I deleted it like a month prior because I was just so sick of all the spam I got.
Well, this is the tricky thing with LinkedIn is that it's a really popular product and also just a really terrible product. And so it's confusing in that regard. Like most things that are that big work. And like this one, like the menus don't always work. I have this one guy in my LinkedIn account. His name is Andrew Madden. Andrew, if you ever listen to this, I know you work at Google and I know you asked to be my friend. And I hope you don't take this personally. I've clicked, I would like to accept your invitation 400 times. He's always there. He's always – I keep talking about it as I do different media things, kind of hoping that maybe someday – because there's no report the bug, right? And so and I've actually been invited to go over to LinkedIn after I wrote this. So I'm going to bring that up too. So I'm going to work this out.
You're going to become friends with Andrew Madden if it's the last thing you do.
I just sort of feel like so when somebody asks, I say, do you guys say yes? Well, you're off, Kathy. You're
yeah,
done.
But I used to say yes. That was a mistake, obviously.
I only get exceptionally strange invites.
Yeah.
Like exceptionally, like really not even – it's not even obvious like how they're related to what I do or write. I assume often they may just be like Russian-created bots that are somehow trying to spy on the U.S.
No, there's definitely are bots. Yeah. There are definitely bots.
I almost always say no because I feel that my life is spent juggling – various messaging feeds. There's the text message. There's the email. There's the Slack. There's the DMs on Twitter. There's all the rest of it. And the last thing I need in this world is the worst messaging product in the world, which is LinkedIn Mail.
It is pretty brutal, that name, the way it gets – like that was a brand that should never have been extended. Like it's – you link in with – so they even screwed – like at least with Google, we're all like, oh, you Google that person. And then they have to worry about their trademark. Like that's never happening with LinkedIn. No one is like – there's no
LinkedIn
generic –
me.
It should be a generic term by now. But it's absolutely not because it's so unusable.
But you say yes to people you don't even know.
It's just such a bad scenario because I feel terrible. But then it's like, we offer consulting services in Guam. And you're just like, oh, God. I don't know what to say. And you kind of just want to be like, not now. But then the problem with LinkedIn is no conversation can ever end because people are pretty aggressive and assertive because the whole thing is just set up to sell you stuff, right? Like you're in a position where you're going to be marketed to.
Well, let's talk about the acquisition a little bit because – you know, you say that it's for marketing, but I until this moment, until Monday, I thought of LinkedIn, and the reason I was willing to be part of it until recently was that it was like, well, maybe an opportunity to actually get a job. Like it aligned with my goals, which is like I always want to have my options open.
And that's where most of LinkedIn's revenue comes from, is that the recruiters pay them to help them find new employees.
Right. Is that true? I have no idea what the majority is.
Most of their revenue comes from headhunters, basically. And I was like, okay, yeah, you should headhunt me and offer me a really good job. But now I'm like, I don't want Microsoft to market to me. That's bullshit. That is not what I signed up for.
Well, I mean, you know, stuff will happen. It happens. They're marketing you right now.
Yeah, but I don't want to volunteer my email space to that, is what I'm saying.
But where was Slate created?
That's a long time ago. That's a past, many moons ago.
So we're literally.
You're saying Slate was created in Microsoft?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Kathy,
I had no idea. But I get paid.
It was originally on that campus.
Look,
yeah.
I don't know my history.
No.
But I do know where my paycheck comes from. Like, the point is, I'm getting paid for this. Whereas, like, LinkedIn is free. Like, I'm volunteering my time to LinkedIn, and fuck that.
Fair. I mean, look, it's. First of all, at least so far, LinkedIn police will not show up at your house yet. and like, can you? Well, also, they would never be able to find it. I mean, that's like, there's no way. But
they are a bit Keystone Cops, aren't they?
That's the problem with the thing. It's so easy to make fun of it because it actually sort of encapsulates all the tacky, exhausting parts about corporate life. Like, it's
a Dilbert cartoon turned into a software product.
Yeah, it just represents it. And the reality is, like, so was up until about 5-6 years ago, so was Microsoft. Like, Microsoft was just the archetypal, like,
oh, but it is.
Giant.
It is. What are you talking about?
It's better now.
So this was part of your piece on Medium, was that actually Microsoft isn't as kind of, like, fuddy-duddy as we used to think of it as.
I mean, I'm getting older. Microsoft's getting older. So there's a part of me, too, now that's just like, oh, I can see what they were trying to do back in 1999. They were doing something really new at an incredibly fast pace. And we're able to kind of look back and be like, oh, but the Mac was so much better. But like Microsoft was just like shoveling software into the universe and changing the way people compute. And it was a disaster and it was sprawling, but it was also very effective. So there's part of me that's like a little bit revisionist about the sort of Microsoft narrative of the 90s where we kind of all the good and virtuous nerds just hated them. But there's another part that's like, no, they really are kind of more focused on design and product. Like they open sourced a code editor. I think it's not Visual Studio, but it's got like some little sub brand, but it is like, it's good. It's good software.
I use the Microsoft Outlook app for iOS to check my Gmail account, and it's much better than the Gmail app.
It's actually excellent. I use it as well. So they're able to land good, high-quality software. They're actually big enough that they're able to communicate pretty clearly about things like privacy policy. And so, like, as far as the giant software entities have to go, behave, they're pretty much comparable at this point to the Googles and the Apples. So you live with these giants.
And yet, there's something incredibly dystopian about this acquisition, right? I mean, this is what your Medium piece
is
about.
Well, it's just too, you know, it's like in a bad sci-fi film where, like, you know, the giant, it's like in Return of the Jedi when the Super Star Destroyer smashes into the Death Star under construction. You're like, yeah! Like, it's the grossest nerd satisfaction possible. Just like, I didn't know those animals that large could mate. And then you're just... You know, I need to see. It's like that slow
motion.
Can we have
Paul on every week?
So you were talking about basically how this just gives, or you were writing about how this kind of gives Microsoft like surveillance power over the corporate world in a sense.
This is so good for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
I mean, you got to think about it, right? LinkedIn has an amazing database of, first of all of the tech giants have their special surveillance capabilities, right? Google knows what everybody's searching for. Amazon actually has a map of all global commerce. Plus, it has like still has sort of white labeled search products. It has AWS for hosting. That's their giant hosting platform that everybody. So all this bandwidth is running through Amazon. They're able to see the world. And Microsoft is worried about getting left behind. It doesn't have a truly great like economic surveillance engine. At this stage, it's not looking at human beings, right? It's looking at patterns. It's a company that's so big that we think about it because of its software because we use that. But it's thinking 5-10 years ahead. Like, where will the global advertising market be in 2035?
Is it the same reasoning that Yahoo bought Tumblr?
No, Yahoo.
Let's not even go there.
Well, I mean, but it was like, oh, now we have all these this customer list.
But I think the idea here, the thing which really scares me, the sort of dystopian vision, is this idea that what's happened is that Microsoft Office and the Microsoft tools that we all have to use when we go into an office because they're pre-installed on our computers. Has now transformed itself from being a piece of software that lives on your computer to being a service that lives in the cloud.
That's right. It's the Office 365.
Right.
Yeah.
And LinkedIn is also a service that lives in the cloud. And when you do things in software, what you're generally doing is working on documents which touch a bunch of people, both inside and outside your company. And so it's very natural to want to sort of layer in the LinkedIn graph and say, well, this person and this person and this person, using their sort of authenticated LinkedIn credentials, are going to be working on this document with me. And suddenly, like, the whole Microsoft you know, if you want to email someone, if you want to share documents with someone, if you want to work with something, you're using LinkedIn for that. And then LinkedIn at that point stops being something that you can opt out of. It stops being something you can delete, and it starts becoming as painful and compulsory as all of the other Microsoft products.
Well, that's right. It's authentication into Planet Microsoft, where we all have to participate if we're going to live in corporate, in the, you know, global corporate system of whatever that we're. I mean, it's just like, so already the PowerPoint of some kind or some sort of deck leaked or semi-leaked. Like, I don't think it was a big
secret. No, it was on the conference call. And it was the most hilarious. So we can't show the slide, which was the slide that everyone was laughing about because it was very visual. There's lots of like random lines not connecting things, and which made no sense. But I can quote from Jeff Weiner, who's the CEO of LinkedIn. He announced this deal on LinkedIn, obviously, with a little letter to all of the LinkedIn employees. And he said that one of the reasons that he's doing this is, quote, realizing LinkedIn's full potential to truly change the world works by partnering with Microsoft to innovate on solutions within the enterprise that are ripest for disruption.
Wow, he put all those words in that one sentence.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, what do they think of us when they write that? Like, I mean, it's because clearly what's happening there is like we're going to make so much money. Let's put these bad boys together. We're going to know what everybody's doing. We're going to jam that into Word, and we're going to go straight to Money Town. And they're like, we have to actually, wait a minute. We got to tell everybody that this is good news. And then it's like, how about we're going to pluck this ripe plum of disruption? I mean, it's just like, what poor PR person had to revise that like 58 times?
I mean, I need to ask you, because this is, you know, this, you used to be in this world.
I'm always in this world.
What does innovate on solutions within the enterprise? Is that actual English, or is it just, is there any meaning there?
You know how sad my life is that I'm just like, sure, they're going to innovate on solutions in the enterprise. Well, yeah, of course. So here's what they're talking about, right? Like, first of all, they're actually not talking about it. They're going like, yeah, we're going to do a bunch of stuff. That's you know that stuff we do? We're going to do so much more of that stuff, and you just probably want to close your eyes because it's going to get grisly. That's what they're actually saying there. I mean, they're going to go, because what are your surfaces here? You've got over here on my right, you've got LinkedIn, and it's got information about what everybody's doing in their life and their job and their career, and it has a portrait of the entire global economy, especially at like the middle management layer. And on the left, you got Microsoft, which knows it now knows how many times you open up Microsoft Excel. It's actually the, you know, per day. It's actually the engine of communication and planning for the entire global economy, right? And so it's kind of like, I mean, this is a real like Ghostbusters, like, you know, Keymaster gatekeeper moment. Like, what's going to happen when you get these guys together? And, you know, it's going to be like a giant Stay Puft Marshmallow Man of a corporate synergy, just like smashing through New York City. Coming for your Excel spreadsheets, and they already have in that deck. They have PowerPoints open, and then there's like a LinkedIn box that pops up with people who can help you get your PowerPoint done, who are from your LinkedIn network.
No,
yeah, no, it's in there. I tweeted out a screenshot of it, and somebody wrote back and was like, "Human Clippy," and that's what it is. We're in that, like, it's like the like end game task rabbit nightmare hellhole that we've all been worried about. Like, they're going to basically make all of work into Uber with this bad boy. It's going to be great.
Awesome. Okay, we are going to
– wow.
On which note
– holy crap.
I want to talk about – the money side of this, because this is even more interesting.
Stay puffed.
That marshmallow.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So the corporate synergy thing is terrifying. The money side of it, this thing, there's a bunch of aspects to this, but the headline aspect of this is $26 billion.
But what, how much cash does Microsoft have?
Well, that's a very interesting comparison. Microsoft has $100 billion in cash.
Yeah,
so, yeah, Microsoft could buy four LinkedIn.
So the next question is, how much of that $100 billion in cash is Microsoft using to pay for LinkedIn?
Not a lot.
The answer is zero.
The answer is zero.
Oh, okay.
Microsoft is actually issuing debt to pay for this.
It's issuing $26 billion in bonds. Now, I don't know how, you know, how much interest rate it's going to have to pay on those bonds. Probably quite low because it's Microsoft. But we're
because
still talking, you know, what, $700 million a year just in debt service to pay for the acquisition of LinkedIn. And LinkedIn, as far as I know, has never made a profit in its existence, or not certainly not $700 million. Like, this is – they're not doing this because LinkedIn is some kind of profitable thing which is going to be accretive to earnings.
No.
I mean,
well, they're specifically, I think they're issuing debt because their actual cash is being held offshore and they don't want to pay the taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is like a tax dodge.
This comes back to the combination of our like just FACACTA, you know, corporate tax system combined with the fact that we give companies the ability to write off interest on debt. If they have to bring over money from overseas, we tax them on that. And so for repatriating, and so they don't want to do that. So what do you do if you don't want to repatriate your money? You go get a loan. And the nice thing about getting a loan to pay for a $26 billion acquisition is then the interest is tax deductible because for some reason we do that in this country.
Just preferential tax treatment.
And so we make it really easy to keep your money overseas.
In other words, if you're Microsoft, and this is kind of crazy, the fact that you're having to spend $700 million a year in interest payments to the people who lent you the $26 billion to buy LinkedIn is not a bug. It's a feature. It means that you get to reduce your taxable income by $700 million and thereby pay fewer taxes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're still losing a little bit of money in interest, but it certainly makes the deal more appealing. And when money's I assume they're borrowing at such a low rate, it's got to be practically free right now. You know, given how when you're talking about a company with $100 billion total in cash, when rates are so low across the market, I mean, everything for a company that wants to keep it's like money clip overseas somewhere, the circumstances are kind of perfect for that.
So. Yeah, I mean, I haven't done the math to figure out like how high interest rates have to rise before people stop doing this, but quite a bit, considering that the actual tax rate, if they bring it in onshore, is like 35%.
Yeah, 35%. Yeah.
So the problem is that Microsoft is a global company, and so it has billions of dollars of income overseas. And it can't just give that money to its shareholders because then it needs to pay 35% tax on it. Yeah, so it's a big tax arbitrage. But the effect of this, I mean, we can talk about Microsoft and probably it makes sense for Microsoft. But the point is that every other company in the world is doing this. And we're artificially incentivizing the corporate sector in the United States to leverage up, to issue debt, even when they don't need to. And didn't we learn during the financial crisis that just issuing lots of debt because it's a good idea is not a story which ends well?
Can I ask a dummy's question?
Yes.
What happens with the $100 billion that's floating around? Where is that? It's not in checking.
Yeah, it's basically in checking.
It is actually in American banks, ironically.
Okay, so it's just sitting
but
in
overseas.
Bank accounts?
It's like, well, I mean, so obviously, you know, you don't get FDIC insurance on $100 billion. So a lot of it is in treasury bills.
Okay, so a lot
of it is in very low interest debt securities. And then every so often, if you're Apple and you have even more cash overseas, you'll do something like throw $1 billion into Didi Chuxing, which is the Chinese Uber competitor, just because you have this extra $1 billion lying around overseas and you've got nothing better to do with it.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I have a really, really dumb question. if it's time, if it's
yeah,
around
no,
for dumb
it.
Questions. I know this is going to be super dumb, but like, look, LinkedIn is publicly traded, right? So the shorthand is that the stockholders own the company. So what does it mean for what happens actually with those stocks? Like, what does it mean for another company to buy the company?
What it means is if you have one share of LinkedIn,
yes,
then you are now going to no longer have that share of LinkedIn, and instead you are going to get $196 in cash.
Oh, you're just going to get paid off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you actually don't have...
I thought it was going to convert to a Microsoft share or something.
No, and you don't really have any rights.
In a stock transaction, it converts to a Microsoft share, but in a cash transaction, you just get paid in cash.
And you kind of can't refuse that, right? Because of your class of stock. If they do that, you're just like, okay.
The board of directors has the right to sell the company, and the board of directors has unanimously agreed to sell the company, so that's what's going to happen.
So when you buy a share of LinkedIn, or when you bought a share of LinkedIn, you were opting into that agreement.
And you might, if you bought the share of LinkedIn 6 months ago, you could have bought that share of LinkedIn for $230, and now you're receiving less than that in cash, and so you're a little bit sad. You're like,
okay, so now I want to, thank you for bringing that up. So let's talk about why now, like, because the theory is that there's a really good reason why this sale happened right now, and it's partly what you just mentioned, that stocks were actually much higher a year ago or 6 months ago.
Well, LinkedIn stock in
LinkedIn
particular.
LinkedIn stocks.
LinkedIn stock lost literally 50% of its value overnight. In February when an earnings report came out. And the earnings weren't particularly bad, but their guidance about the future, they were like, yeah, we're not going to make as much money as we thought we were going to make. And then just the whole company just sold off.
And that really mattered to LinkedIn for this weird reason, which is that most of their employees are being paid mostly in stocks. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, but there's a lot of employees who are like, oh, give me a small salary, but give me lots of stocks. And so those people... And they're especially the super smart people that have lots of job options because they're on LinkedIn. those people saw their value of this large part of their salary which is in stocks, that value going down by 50%, and they were like, "Fuck this! I'm going to get another job, possibly, or if this keeps on happening, I'll get another job." So everybody at LinkedIn was like shitting their pants.
When they were looking to sell, right, they'd gone to Salesforce. And Salesforce was going to buy LinkedIn, and then their bankers went to Microsoft and said, hey, a Salesforce.
And then there was a sort of bidding war.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, that happens with all of these. Like, it's true that when
certain tech companies, LinkedIn is one of them, and Twitter is by far the worst, just shovel equity out the door to their employees. The cost of stock-based compensation at Twitter and LinkedIn is absolutely astronomical. And
let's try seeing that chart. Like, it's way over on the right, and everybody else is just sort of back, like in the first quadrant.
Yeah, if you work for a normal company, people won't be like, you get to participate in the stockholding plan, so where we'll give you a little thing.
I actually have a number here. That LinkedIn paid $510 million in stock-based compensation last year, which isn't that much compared to the Microsoft debt payments, but it is 96% of their operating income. So, and also 16% of their revenue. That's a way more than most, like Apple and Google. They also pay stock-based compensation, but not at that level.
Do we know why they are so into that? Why stock-based compensation is something like why those two companies in particular?
Well, I mean, it's popular. In places like Amazon and Twitter and LinkedIn because it means you don't need to pay in cash, right? And it like a company can print stocks for free.
Yeah.
And so it's effectively – they feel like it's free. Now, under generally accepted accounting principles, it's not free. But but Silicon Valley has kind of trained Wall Street to ignore GAAP principles.
I was going to say, when their earnings come out, you always see the two, and they always put the non-GAAP first as if that's like their real
– they're pointing at the better number, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like a leveraging up. They're like, oh, we can get better people if we – we don't have to pay them more. But we just offer them more stocks.
But you're absolutely right, Kathy, that this is something which works until it doesn't. And when your stock stops going up and your stock starts going down, then you wind up in this kind of death spiral. Because what happens is that the employees don't really care what the stock price is. What they care about is how much money it's worth. And so if your stock price goes down, you need to give them twice as much, goes down by 50%. You need to give them twice as much stock in order for that, for their income to stay flat. And so what happens is, as the stock price goes down, you wind up shoveling more and more and more stock at them in order for their income to stay flat, which just dilutes the amount of stock outstanding even further. So that drives the stock price down even further. So you wind up printing even more stock, and then you get into this vicious cycle.
And if you don't do that, then all the best people in your company leave. So that's also like the brain drain problem, which they don't want.
Or you just go and mate with Microsoft.
But the other thing is, the funny thing is, like, usually when you mate with Microsoft,
usually.
Which I do
usually.
All the time.
Every time, like, I open Word.
I was going to say, that's how.
That's what I call clicking on an icon.
Like wouldn't most people quit anyway? I don't know. I mean, I feel like the brain drain is real.
No, I think that the message around. So first of all, you went and worked for LinkedIn. So it's not like you went and worked for. No, but seriously, like, you went and worked for the place that said, we're going to build a giant enterprise-grade social network that changes the way people work. Like, you didn't go work for, like, you know, we're going to connect all human beings and make families stronger. Like, whatever the mission – if you go and see the mission statement – like, the mission statement for Pinterest is going to be a lot more attractive. It's going to be like, we're going to change the nature of the visual world or something like that. And you go to LinkedIn and it's just like, we're going to slowly extinguish the tire fire we created. Like, that's the – so –
corporate drones done well.
Right. So Microsoft, if I'm at LinkedIn and I've met a couple people, know a couple people at LinkedIn. Hi. And they, this will be yet more emails in my inbox. But the general sense is like, oh my God, what have I beholded? You know, and just like, it's a fascinating place to work. It's a giant platform. You're doing big things at scale, but at the same time, you're like, what's happening? Which I think is any big enterprise that's under a lot of change. Like, I actually don't think LinkedIn's particularly worse or better than any company that's in its situation. Microsoft is a very well-run professional company. You go in there at a high level and they have great executive assistants. Your travel's taken care of. They'll do your laundry. Like, it works really, really well for the people who work there. When they leave, they go out into the world and then they're like, wow, I miss it. Like, it is a very nurturing, caring environment. You have to totally believe in Microsoft to be there. Like, you have to actually get into the cult. But when they're paying you really well, it's pretty good.
And I want to talk just very briefly about this cult, because one of the things which surprised me and probably shouldn't have surprised me about the success of LinkedIn was that they created these blog posts from, you know, CEOs, which were written by some robot somewhere, you know, where you'd get Richard Branson
not a robot,
talking
just a sad human.
That's
or
why.
Sad
I,
human.
That's another reason I quit.
And basically, what they found was that there was an insane appetite to read utter management blather about, you know, disrupting solutions in the enterprise. And
but who is reading that? Not humans, like other people who are also writing that blather. Like, people
yeah,
aren't
but
reading
there are, there,
No, people
a,
are reading
There's a large – that's called millions that's every marketing MBA.
No, but that's the thing. Like, on LinkedIn, they're reading it, but not people. Like, not – like, I mean – like, not like – like, no one is sitting there going, like, oh, I'm going to take the bus, maybe get a cup of coffee and better read that LinkedIn. Unless there's someone who's also like, I'm going to write
– So, like, I got to tell you, I worked for a brief period in the marketing department of a law firm. So we're talking, like, middle management of, like, a despised corner of a mid-sized law firm, right?
Okay.
And I'm still connected to some of those people on LinkedIn, and some of them really sincerely share that blather. It's like – it's not like – and I see their smiling face pop up when they share it. And partly it's because they're looking for something to share on LinkedIn so that then people will come to them and maybe headhunt them to their next middle management
job. I feel
job.
That's the tricky thing with LinkedIn is it's actually sort of hermetically sealed from what we would consider reality, right? Like it's like there's no bad news getting in on this. It's always like the 12 most inspirational marketing strategies you can use to communicate with your LinkedIn community. Like it's all like – it's self-referential stuff.
It's just like amazing philosophical solipsism. Like,
yeah, it's can you create – I think for some people, it's their job. They get up in the morning and they're like, okay, I need to strengthen my connections across the LinkedIn network.
And it's also performative.
Yeah.
In the way that, like, people aren't sharing the stuff that they actually believe in, but they're sharing the stuff that they think is going to make them look good.
Yeah, that's right.
Potential employees.
Let's bring that up because, like, my theory is that people really only perform on LinkedIn unless they're actually being paid directly for it when they want to get a job. So then it comes up this question, like, people, like, corporate environments that use Microsoft products, are they really going to want all their like employees to be linked in at all times? Because that would bring on the headhunters, wouldn't it? Like, wouldn't they be losing employees by this connection?
Yeah, but everybody's already dealing with that. Like, and I mean, everybody already, like, people are watching LinkedIn now to see how their employees are doing and when, you know, you have to be careful about, one of the things I always advise people to do is if you're going to update your profile is, friend your boss at that time. Be like, oh, hey, just getting everything all like buttoned up. Right? Like,
you've just ruined that strategy.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. There are other strategies. But we live in this world of constant, perpetual, mutual spying. Like, I have a company with myself and my co-founder, we have around 40 people. I don't go look at their profiles. It's up to them. Like, you just, what am I going to do? I'm not going to spy on my people. I have to, like, that's just bad management.
No, you hire someone to do that for you.
Well, that's the thing. That is actually the thing that's going to be amazing is Microsoft's going to have that as a service. Like, indirectly, you're going to get, it'll be like, oh, you know, you're going to be able to see aggregate snapshots of your own employees, I think, with this tool. And there are other things that let
you do
that.
Like a report, like a daily dashboard. Yeah. Right? Like, which of your employees is like trying to fly the coop?
But actually what's more interesting is the competitive. Like, I want to know, if I'm Microsoft, I want to know, what is Google doing? The thing that I was thinking about is like the Google Google employees can go home and open up their Xboxes, right? I'm going to have a unified login across all of Microsoft. I'm going to know, like, hey, that team at Google is like kind of getting lazy. They're going home at 6 p.m. It's poaching time. Let's go in there, right? Like, because I own Xbox. I know when people are opening things. I know whose boss just got promoted. I know all that stuff about my competitors, about
Paul,
Facebook.
You're scaring me. Okay.
But this is how internet advertising works now.
Like, HR departments are slowly but surely becoming the most evil corner of corporate America, if they weren't already.
How? Already troll people on social media. I mean, this is just making it easier.
Yeah. We're all going to get to spy on each other all the time. It's just this nice, big, mutual panopticon where you thought you were doing word processing and it turns out that you're like, you were writing a letter to your sister, but then she pops up in the window right there. And you're like, oh, but she doesn't even know you're looking at her. And then you're like, what's she doing? And she's baking that cake wrong. And then, you know, it's just, it's going to be great. We're going to have so much fun.
Okay.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so the final segment is about insider trading, because if you buy Snapchat or WhatsApp or any of these other social networks, you just pay a bunch of money and you buy them, and that's the end of the story. But with LinkedIn, it's a bit more complicated because, as Kathy said, LinkedIn was a public company and there were millions of people who owned LinkedIn stock. And if the news leaks, then what you can do is you can go out into the market and buy the stock and make money because you know that Microsoft is going to pay much more than the market price.
They ended up paying, like, it jumped up 40% or something.
Yeah.
So you could just make 40% return in like 2 days.
You could make much more than that because there are these wonderful things called call options.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do if you really want to make money is you buy, okay, brace yourselves, I'm going to go super financial jargon here, short-dated, out-of-the-money call options.
Yeah.
Which means that if Microsoft – if LinkedIn is trading at $130 a share, what you do is you buy the right to buy stock in like a week's time at $160 a share. And everyone's like, why on earth would you want to buy LinkedIn stock at $160 a share when it's trading at $130? I will sell you that I will sell you 600 options to do that. And it will cost you $135,000. And that's just $135,000, which is free money for me. And then what happens is Microsoft swoops in. The price goes up to $200 a share. And those options, which were only worth $135,000, you know, yesterday, are today worth $2 million. And you've just made $1.9
million. So, I mean, just to be a little bit even nerdier. I mean, the point is that you're buying it from someone who has a sort of naive concept of what the likelihood is of the stock market the next few days, right? So they have this idea of a distribution of the likelihood of it being that high, and they're like, very unlikely. So I'm willing to sell you these call options for very cheap. So it's not that those call options were actually priced correctly, right? They just didn't know it. You had more information than the
public information. They may have been priced correctly. But so we're talking about this because Fortune went and took a look at the kind of movement in the options market right before this sale. And they noticed, lo and behold, there was a big spike in options trading the Friday before the deal. And so there's
– and not just on the Friday, but like in the last 5 minutes of trade.
Exactly. And so they were saying, this looks like maybe there's some insider trading, since these short-dated out-of-the-money call options are kind of like the signature tool that people use to
– easy to find out that this happened,
but,
right?
So here's what's interesting. Some academics have looked at this subject, right, of specifically looking at these securities or at these derivatives, these call options. And this kind of activity happens about 25% of the time on like big acquisitions or like the kind of stuff that Fortune was seeing. Like, and sometimes it's happening weeks before. It's not happening like on the weekend before necessarily. And so that kind of suggests one of two things. Either there is, in fact, just like a ton of insider trading that's happening constantly and not getting caught, or, and this is Matt, our favorite guy on Bloomberg, Matt Levine's theory, is that before deals leak, not necessarily information that would count as insider trading gets out, but there are signals that kind of start to filter in the market and cause some instability. And maybe that's why you constantly see this volatility right around the time.
Like signals as in you see people going into meeting rooms?
Well, that would be one thing. But I mean,
that would be
so this
insider
is like,
trading.
This is like Jungian economics. This is just like art that's playing. Like the, some sort of weird synchronicity occurs. Like you're just like the back of your neck.
I think Occam's razor basically tells us that the obvious explanation is the true one, and that there were hundreds of people who knew about this deal, and that somehow, you know, it's very unlikely that that many people can keep a secret for that long. This deal took a very long time to put together, and someone found out about the deal and they got greedy and they bought a bunch of options in order to make lots of money.
But they're going to get caught.
Okay, so this is the interesting thing. It's very easy for the SEC to, and whenever one of these deals happen, they do this, they'll look at the options trading and they'll look at who bought the options, and then they will try and sort of trace back some connection from that person to the deal. And if they can work out that that person received inside information, then they can prosecute them. But there are interesting ways in which the you can get away with this.
Mm-hmm.
One is that you say that you weren't insider trading. You were doing some clever option strategy. So, for instance, there was activity in the $160 calls. There was also strange activity in the $175 calls, where there was this thing called the Iron Condor, where at the same time...
Stop there.
I just want to like go, ca-ca.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, really, is anything you're going to say now going to add to that?
So the Iron Condor is a relatively common options trading strategy where you buy out-of-the-money call options and buy out-of-the-money put options at the same time. So you buy the right to sell at a price much lower than the current price. And what you're doing is essentially betting on volatility in the stock. And if you're saying – if you can go up to the SEC and say, well, I was just betting on volatility. I didn't know that a thing was coming. And again, they can't prove that you got the information somewhere. It's hard, it's more plausible that this is a real trade. But the thing which I want to talk about is that, let's say that I, Felix, am, you know, coming up in the elevator at Metro Tech in Brooklyn, and I overhear two guys in the elevator, and they work for some law firm, and they're like, oh yeah, I'm working on that deal where Microsoft is buying LinkedIn, which is something, of course, which they shouldn't say, but it's not illegal for them to say that in an elevator. It's just really stupid. If I overhear them saying that in the elevator, and I have no idea who they are, and I've never met them before, and I will never meet them again, and I just call up my broker and say, load up on short-dated out-of-the-money call options, that's totally legal. I have not broken the law.
You just give me a new fun game to play whenever I'm in an elevator. I'm just going to just talk to whoever I'm with. I mean, like, you know, I've been working on that deal where...
Apple was by Google.
Wasn't that like fairly recent too, that like the decision in the courts was that you had to have like some certainty that the information you were getting was coming from a source that would know that, like, as long as there's some plausible deniability on your part that these people, your source of information was actually informed, you're pretty much good.
I mean, I guess that's the point is that if you don't know whether that person was joking or just making shit up, then like, yeah.
It is the risk.
You can take your own risk. Yeah. You know?
And mostly under insider trading, there needs to be some kind of quid pro quo. That the person receiving the tip needs to be doing something or paying something to the person giving the
kickback.
So if you're giving that guy $60,000 in a Ferragamo bag, then that's insider trading. You know?
It just all feels like weird house rules in the world's dumbest casino. Like, it's just like, at this point, it's like, just give up. Just let raw, naked capitalism win rather than, what are you going to do? Just come up with more rules?
There is actually a relatively compelling libertarian case for making all insider trading legal and just saying, let the market have at it. And,
all right, just get on your offshore seasteading, like, trading desk.
And, seasteading is the key. Right?
That is exactly it. Like right off of Governor's Island, so you're close to the markets. It's going to be great. Let's do this.
There's this.
Why are we doing podcasts?
The SEC is built on this idea that there's a level playing field in the stock market and everyone has the same information at the same time. Everybody knows that this is a fiction. So why not just embrace the fiction? This is the same argument as saying that all of the athletes at the Olympics should be allowed to dope because, you know, why not just embrace the fact that it's going to happen anyway?
That's bad. You're right. Then it's no longer a really fun competition that we all get to watch and pretend is fair.
Right.
Yeah. That's too bad.
We are so cynical today.
I'm very cynical. Gosh. I probably brought it down. I'm a little, anyway.
Never mind. Okay. I feel like that's a natural end to the cynical Microsoft, LinkedIn, horrible garbage fire of a merger.
Let's wish those two kids great, great futures together. I mean, I think it's, you know, Microsoft, LinkedIn.
I'm still imagining them as some sort of like midair mating thing.
Well, that's the thing. Your clouds merging is the new form of intercourse for giant companies.
Oh, I need to ask Paul Ford. Yeah. Just because we have Paul Ford in, and this is a rare and special thing. People love to talk about the cloud. Is there any difference between the cloud and the internet?
Yes. The internet refers to a collection of hardware that's all talking the same protocol or language and exchanging information along those different protocols using a set of rules. So, like, the internet works port 80 on a computer, like a port that a ship sails into, is the official port of HTTP, and that's how the web works on the internet based on top of the TCP/IP protocol. Like, it's just stacks of things. The cloud refers to somebody else's computer times a billion. Like, the cloud is we set up a whole bunch of computers in a giant data center in what used to be an aluminum smelting town, and now we're using that the electricity produced by the dam to power these machines. Well, when you have a million computers together, it's a very different problem than having two computers. You need to figure out how to coordinate them, how to track if one goes down, and then you can start to cut them up, lease and sell services. You know, they become a commodity essentially. And so, what the cloud is a set of commodities that get produced by having a ton of computers in one big area or multiple big areas spread all over. So what instead of buying one big mainframe and doing all your computing there, now you go to Amazon, who had surplus capacity, and set up a thing called Amazon Web Services where you could kind of rent access to all their tools, which already involve thousands and thousands of computers to do all the things that Amazon does. And you can now go and I can get you 500 computers running at once, and we can use those as one sort of virtual mega web server because you have a billion people coming to look at something, like if you're a Netflix.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't want to disappear down this rabbit hole too much, but does it make sense, you know, like does my – if I visit Facebook,
mm-hmm.
is that a website or am I like pulling information from the cloud? Is there no distinction there?
Both.
It's both. Accessing a set of services across multiple computers. That's actually how ad networks work. Like if you go to the Times, you're actually hitting like the New York Times, you're hitting like 80 separate computers as all the ads show up and the images are over here on this computer and the homepage is over here on this. So basically, no, I mean, Facebook is so big that it cuts everything up into little tiny pieces. There's the machines that do Messenger and let you do the chat. And then there's the machines that do the wall. And there's lots of them together all in concert because you literally can't build one computer big enough to do all that work. So they had to figure out how to split it up.
Yep.
So Facebook has a cloud is another way of saying it.
Yeah,
so,
Facebook
has a cloud. And Microsoft LinkedIn is just when clouds meet.
It is. This is a giant – so you're going to go – and what Microsoft is doing is moving all their applications and software into the cloud. Now, you still download it and run it locally on your machine. Unless you use the web versions. And the same is also, you know, Adobe's doing that too. Like you now buy Photoshop and all the related things by downloading them from, and they update and they're sort of managed.
Talking of, and we should allow you to plug your amazing recent podcast with Coy Vinh, who now works for Adobe.
That's correct. Felix is referring to Track Changes, which is the name of my company, Postlight. We do a corporate newsletter and a corporate podcast, very, very corporate in every possible way, as corporate as can be. And so we encourage people to listen to that. You can find it in all the regular places. Just search Track Changes Postlight.
Your podcast should start inviting people to connect on LinkedIn just to be a little bit more corporate.
We actually did do a LinkedIn episode with just myself and my business partner, Richard Ziade, just kind of inchoately screaming for about 35 minutes, just like, what the rah? It's just yelling, upset.
Yeah,
angry.
It's a common reaction to LinkedIn. Okay, that's it for LinkedIn, but we do have a numbers round.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I have a very happy, non-cynical number today, which is 91.
Okay.
91, which is, first of all, my favorite number because it's the first number that looks prime but isn't. Just think about that. But it's also really important this week because it's the number of emails we got from our listeners.
Ooh.
Remember last week we asked people if they knew what Rikers Island was and what Ferragamo brand was?
Bags. Yes.
Bags or shoes?
Ties.
Well, 91 people wrote in, and I was like all weekend and all week I kept on thinking I had way more friends than I actually do because email, you've got a new email. Yay, you got another email. And I was like, oh my God, all these people. And I'm going to just assume they are my friends. But anyway, 91 of them wrote in. And for the most part, they knew both. But of the people that only knew one, I think almost all of them only knew Rikers Island. And it's because of the Law and Order, of course. Law and Order.
It's because of the TV.
Yes, the TV.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for writing in. You guys are amazing.
And on the subject of writing in, I have another request because obviously asking people to write to us is a good thing that we should do. SlateMoney@slate.com. What I want to know this week, please, this would be super, super helpful, is what are your favorite podcasts? Just that. Like, what do you listen to? Do you listen to track changes? Do you listen to things which aren't track changes, which apparently there are other podcasts which aren't track changes?
Ours is pretty great, actually, for where we're, you know, we're just a company, but we're doing real good.
But yeah, so just let us know what you listen to, because it's actually very hard for people sitting in podcasting studios to know that much about their audience. And we want to know, like, what do you like out there? Because mostly just because we want to listen to it. But let us know. Paul, what's your number?
No one told me I had a number. Now I'm sitting here trying to figure out the factors on 91, and I really was going to. Kathy.
Paul,
just,
what are the factors of 91?
I don't know that either. Like, Kathy think broke my it. Brain completely.
Think about it, Paul. What are the factors? No, you're not allowed to get your phone out.
We're coming back to you.
We're coming back to Paul while he's managed to work out the prime factors of 91. My number is $2 million. $2 million is – this is related to a Senate investigation. Senator Grassley just finished up a 300-page Senate investigation of the American Red Cross, my favorite. Yeah. I love to hate the American Red Cross. So the American Red Cross raised a whole bunch of money for Haiti, and no one knows where it went, and they were dissembling and lying to the Senate. And one of the things that they spent money on was that they gave $4.3 million to the International Federation of the Red Cross, which is the sort of international sister organization, which then sort of peeled off its own administrative costs and gave the rest to disaster preparedness work in Haiti.
Yeah.
So that's okay. Like, the International Federation of the Red Cross, I don't hate those people. They're actually an okay charity. And if you want to give them $4.3 million for Haiti, that's okay. The American Red Cross, however, also charged money to manage giving the $4.3 million to their sister, right? Because you can't just write a check for $4.3 million. You need to sort of manage the writing of the check. How much did they charge for managing writing a $4.3 million check? $2 million.
That's messed up. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Bring us back from the edge, Jordan.
So my number's an update. My number's 90 million, which is the bid from the publisher Ziff Davis for Gawker Media. We've obviously talked about the Peter Thiel campaign of destruction, total war, salting of the fields against all of Nick Denton's family and holdings, and of course Gawker itself. So Gawker went into bankruptcy in order to essentially prepare to sell itself off in a way that, you know, they could, because outside of bankruptcy, that'd be practically impossible. And they are starting off with this opening bid from a company that is right now known for basically publishing PC Magazine. And so that leaves open a lot of questions about what the future of Gawker is going to be exactly. Although they've said they want to keep on, or this particular opening bid does include a deal to keep on Denton as a consultant for 2 years. But even so, that's only 2 years long term. It does kind of make you wonder what their plans are for this kind of, you know, not very PC Magazine-esque media company.
All right, Paul, what are the prime factors of 91?
I have two numbers now. Well, actually three, because there's two. If you multiply 13 and 7, you get 19.
Ah, 13 and 7.
I kept thinking 17. I got in trouble there. Anyway, I have a really great number for everyone. It's from Microsoft's website, and it tells us that the number is 984,000. Ready? It's the number of orders of French fries that Microsoft employees in Redmond, Washington eat at the campus cafeteria. So that's the kind of data that you can look forward to seeing about everyone in your life.
Per what?
Per year. I mean, let's assume. It's not per day.
It's a lot of French fries.
Yeah. So that's there you go. Yeah, actually, you're right. Well, they didn't say the per.
Yeah, wait. How many employees do they have at that campus?
Oh, who knows? Soon, probably. I don't know.
Soon, you know, I'll be an employee.
I'm never coming back on this podcast.
Paul killed the numbers round.
If you're going to just ask me, yeah, it's just if someone had warned me, I would have made something up.
I can't
up.
Believe we didn't warn you.
I got an email that just said numbers at the bottom. I was just like, oh, that looks fun. That's
All right. But 13 and 7 are good numbers.
Those are great. Yeah, I guess 984,000, not so good.
No, 984,000. I feel like the fact that Microsoft measures that is actually actually much more interesting than the number itself.
I'm sure like their point of POS system has to do that at the very least.
But it just shows how excited they are about measuring things about people. And that's the, something we get to look forward
to.
Great.
I feel
like if they were in Northern California, they wouldn't even have French fries. It would all be like healthy snacks.
Should we get out of here before Ziff Davis buys this podcast?
Let's get out of here. Paul Ford, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Slate Money. It was so much fun. And I feel like we will never live up to it anymore.
Yeah, that's it.
That was it. That was the greatest episode ever of Slate Money. You can all unsubscribe now. if you want to subscribe on the off chance that you might enjoy a future episode without Paul Ford, or on the even smaller chance that Paul Ford might accept an invite to come back some other time and you get to hear him again, you can find us by searching for Slate Money. But do write to us and let us know what your favorite podcasts are. The address is slatemoney@slate.com. And all that leaves is for me to thank Audrey Quinn, the producer, the executive producers, Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers. Tell you to check out all of the rest of the Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. And we will talk to you next week in the special Brexit edition of Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.